Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office. Today, we'll take up China demand. We'll talk about the growing support and need within China for more livestock products, red meat, and dairy products. We'll do that with Carl Zuloff of the Ohio State University and Extension there. But before that, we'll take up the Phase 1 trade agreement and how the Chinese did on meeting the agricultural portion of that agreement for the 2020 year. I spoke with North Dakota State University Extension agricultural economist Frayne Olson earlier in the month and asked him to recap the Phase 1 trade agreement.
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks. First, appreciate the opportunity to visit. And you're absolutely right. Because the soybeans that are grown in this part of the U.S. Almost exclusively go into the Chinese market, the Asian market in general, but China specifically, you know, our local prices are very, very sensitive to this. So I get a lot of questions about, what is the Phase 1 agreement? Where are we at? What does it look like? What are the impacts? And so first we have to do a super brief recap. So in the Phase 1 trade agreement, there's actually two chapters out of the six chapters in the total agreement. Two of them have an impact on agriculture. One of them is specifically targeting agricultural products, and the other one is what they call expanding trade, which is really the Chinese promise to purchase additional agricultural products. And those two are actually interconnected and linked. And the grain markets today, both corn, soybeans, and to some degree wheat, have been impacted both directly and indirectly from those provisions. So very quickly, the Chapter 6 on expanding trade, where China promised to buy more U.S. ag products, is the one that's gotten the most public attention. That's the one that I get a lot of questions on. How are we doing? Are we on track? Are they ahead or behind? But the Chapter 3 actually has equally important, because those Chapter 3 allowed, it is negotiated where it allows the U.S. agricultural products to enter China more easily. It's all of these non-tariff trade barriers. It's this sanitary, phytosanitary regulations. It was the GM regulations. So, for example, up until recently, you know, the U.S. exporter still had to certify that there was no MIR 162 traits in corn leaving the United States and entering China, because China had not approved the MIR 162 trait. Well, this phase, Chapter 3 of Phase 1, allowed that U.S. corn to enter. And look what's happened. Yes, there's a strong underlying demand for feed products in China, but that removing that hurdle, removing that limitation, allowed a lot more corn to flow into the Chinese market. Okay, so let's go to Chapter 6, which is the one about reaching the targets. And there's still some debate about, you know, what is the actual target? So the agreement said China in calendar year 2020 would purchase an additional $12.5 billion of U.S. ag products over a 2017 number. We don't know the exact 2017 number. It's kind of being debated, but it's between $20 and $24 billion. So it's, you know, pretty large number, but they agreed to purchase an additional 12.5. Well, $19.5 billion is a target for 2021, which is, again, a very large number. So the question, will they reach the 2020 numbers? Probably not. It will likely be the total dollar volume purchased will likely be above what we saw in 2017, but I don't think the increase will be large enough to reach the target. So now another question, what happens? Are we going to see the shortfall from 2020 be rolled into the 2021 number and increasing the 2021 number? Or is this simply going to be, well, we didn't quite make it, so we're just going to shift into the 2021 number? You know, these are all really important targets. China does have the underlying feed demand as well as demand for animal protein. So we are exporting quite a bit of pork as well as some poultry into the Chinese market now, which we have not done in a long, long, long time. So we're at this linkage between the Chinese market and the U.S. agricultural market now has become a lot stronger. It's become a much greater influence than it was before. But which is a good thing because we're now seeing higher agricultural prices, but also means that this risk of additional trade issues as we move forward in time may actually have more widespread effect on U.S. agriculture.
What are the stumbling blocks that you've been considering on that point?
Well, there's a few of them. and again, these are all open for debate and kind of observation. But the ones that have traditionally been listed the last couple of years, have been obviously intellectual property rights. It's been access to banking and finance. It's been business investment, where not only U.S. companies operating in China, what they can do, but also Chinese companies operating in the United States. A few new ones that have now kind of been added, and I think that given the change in administration now, the Biden administration will have some additional things that they're going to add to the list that potentially could cause issues. One of them, of course, is the oversight of Hong Kong, and that's been in, you know, politically in the news for a while. There's some concerns about Taiwan and the independence of Taiwan. Mainland China has been, from a military standpoint, kind of teasing the Taiwanese, and with some flyovers of their jets and some military sea operations in the Sea of China. So Taiwan is a very close political ally with the United States. You know, how far will the mainland China push the Taiwan independence? There's been some issues about COVID-19, about, you know, the source of COVID-19 and the response that China had with releasing information. There's quite a difference in environmental standards now between what we see in the United States and what we see in China. There's a lot of labor issues that I know are really important for trade deals, making sure that we have equitable trade so that the labor requirements in the United States are very similar to the ones that we have in our trading partners. There's also human rights issues. There's been some issues, some concerns about importing Chinese products from certain parts of China into the United States, because the claim is that there's human rights abuses going on in those provinces. So, you know, this, again, double-edged sword with trade with China. On one side, there's the demand and the demand base, and the United States is well-positioned to be able to supply not only feed products, but also animal protein into the Chinese market, which is, you know, obviously helping our U.S. prices. But if our linkage becomes tighter, China becomes a larger customer of U.S. agriculture. That also means that if there are political tensions, or if there's additional things come on the line or cause problems between U.S. and China, what does that do to the agricultural markets if there's these issues that do come up, if additional disputes become a major trade blockage? You know, when China put a tariff on U.S. soybeans, we took about $2 out of the soybean market. You know, could the same thing happen if we have another dispute? I'm not saying it will. I'm not saying that it's going to be a major shift in politics. But it is one of those risks that we have to think about as we move forward in time.
In the 2021 calendar year, which of the agricultural commodities would you expect to benefit most from the Phase One trade agreement?
So I've actually tried to track that. The USDA does keep track of the value as well as volume, but the value of U.S. egg products entering China. They're always a couple months behind in reporting what actually has happened, but so we have information through October. So from January through October, the largest value, the product with the largest value, was soybeans, which is what we saw also in 2017. The number two was actually pork. The amount of pork in 2017 that we shipped into China was rounding error. And now today, it's about $1.4 billion, which is so they're number two on the list behind soybeans at about $7.8 billion. Number three for the 2020 numbers is cotton, and cotton was actually number two back in 2017. The fourth is grain sorghum, And again, the very similar numbers, grain sorbent shipments in 2017 versus 2020, very similar. But the one that probably impacts your listeners the most is corn. Corn is now listed as number 5 on the list. And in 2017, again, it was so far down, it was hardly worth counting. Poultry meat is number 6. So the value of products that we're shipping, soybeans is still number 1. And that's the one that I think everybody has this connection between U.S. agriculture and China. But pork, corn, and poultry have also benefited pretty substantially from this phase one agreement.
And you think corn will be in a better position for next year?
I do. I do think that corn will be. Now, China is the second largest corn producer in the world, right behind the U.S. So they produce a lot of their own corn, and they consume almost all of it domestically. They have some pretty large corn reserves, but those corn reserves are starting to come down. Their government-owned reserves, kind of like our old CCC grain reserve days, and they do sell some of those reserves in case there's a production problem. But if we look at the current forecast for corn consumption versus corn production in China, there's quite a deficit. And there's two ways you can make up that deficit. One is to try and import off the global market. And the second, of course, is to bring your reserves down. And China is actually doing some of both. And the current thought, at least in the marketplace, for both some of the USDA forecasts, but also some of the private forecasts for corn exports or the importation, the China's import appetite off the global market, as well as their reserves. Their reserves are forecasted to continue to come down over the next several years. And the forecast or the expectation is that they're going to import more corn off the global market. And the two to three places you can get, four countries you can get a lot of corn, U.S., Brazil, Argentina, and Ukraine. Those are the four largest corn exporters of the world. So it's not like China has to come to the U.S., but we are by far the largest supplier, have the largest quantities available into the global market. So I do think corn is going to be one of those benefits. I think grain sorghum will also be one of those crops that may benefit. Now, obviously, a much smaller crop in the U.S. But again, I do think we will export meat products directly into China as well. So some of our corn and soybean exports will go in the form of meat instead of bulk commodity.
And do the corn exports from the United States go out the PNW or do they go out New Orleans?
Most of it goes out of New Orleans. Most of it goes out of the Gulf. There is some that will travel out to PNW, but just because of the sheer volumes involved and being able to source the corn at the lowest price possible, coming out of New Orleans is actually a little bit more efficient for corn shipments. It's not impossible to get corn, obviously, from you know the Dakotas here, for example, through the PNW, but the majority of flows through the Gulf. Now, the challenge is if you're going to go through the Gulf because of transit times, because of the shipment times that are required, it needs a little bit more lead time coming out of the Gulf versus the PNW.
That's Frayne Olson from North Dakota State University Extension. He's an agricultural economist. I spoke with him earlier in the month about the Phase 1 trade agreement with China and how that nation had done in the 2020 portion of the agreement and what he expects for 2021. Let's look a little further down the line now as it relates to the livestock sector. Carl Zuloff of The Ohio State University has penned an article for the Farm Doc Daily website considering the export market to China as it relates to beef and pork and dairy products, and I asked him why it was he wrote the article that looks at this century and what the past might tell us about the future.
Well, we wanted to look at really what was the trend, but from a big perspective, not to get into the small details, to look at it from the standpoint of in terms of the meat and dairy article. What percent of domestic consumption in China is now being covered by imports as opposed to domestic production in China?
So what's the first takeaway?
The first takeaway has been the particularly since the 2010-2011 years, the rapid growth in the sourcing of domestic consumption of beef by imports from China, and they went from about 0.4% of their domestic consumption from beef in 2011 to 17.5% in 2018 being sourced by imports. Pork went from 0.8% in 2011 to 2.6% in 2018. The reason we stop at 2018 is the African swine flu breakout caused imports of all kinds of meat to really surge in 2019 and 20. That's probably not sustainable. Well, I would expect that not to be sustainable in the future. In fact, I just read that the Chinese government said their hogs herd is now somewhere around 90% back to normal. So I would expect the surge of imports in 19 and 20 to back off.
Yeah, and that surge is important because it's not a small surge from 17 to 1920, right?
No, it's not a small surge at all. If you look at their one way to look at that is look at their share of world imports. In 2020, they had 44% of the share of world exports in pork, 26% in beef and 8% in chicken. So they were huge players in all of the meat imports in 2020, reflecting the African swine flu breakout.
How many pounds do they bring in?
I can't tell you how many pounds they bring in. I can tell you that from 2011 to 2012 to 2018, the annual increase was 423 million tons of beef per year, million pounds of beef per year. Sorry, it's not tons. So they were importing an additional each year, an average increase of 423 million pounds of beef and 235 million pounds of pork. So that's quite an annual increase.
Anything on the dairy sector?
The dairy sector, also, you've seen a big surge in imports as a source, particularly for dairy products since 2011. The reason we started with 2011 for dairy was because USDA was not reporting statistics before then. We're using the USDA, what's it called, the Production Supply and Distribution Database, which is one of the big internationally recognized databases on this. But dairy imports had surged quite a bit, particularly for the dairy products, butter, cheese, nonfat dried milk. Their imports of milk actually went up quite a bit, but it was a relatively small percentage. It went from like about 0 to 2.6%, whereas their imports of butter as a source of domestic consumption is about 50% of production or 50% of consumption, and 90% of the nonfat dried milk that they consume is coming from imports. So huge imports into the dairy sector, particularly in the product as well as in the fluid milk areas.
So their demand has stimulated increases of exports to that country in recent years. What do you see going forward?
I would see that I think the trends from 2011 to 2018 on meat, 2011 to 2020 in dairy, because dairy didn't show a huge surge due to AFS. So I would see those trends as being more representative of the future than what happened in 19 and 20. And with the exception of chicken, imports were becoming a consistently, not spectacularly, but consistently larger share of domestic consumption in China. The most rapid growth was beef, and it will be interesting to see if they continue to do that. In terms of broader perspective, which I think is what you're asking for here, one of the big questions that has sort of hung over the markets for the last 20 years has been, would China develop a Western diet or adopt a more Western diet? In other words, a more protein, meat protein-based diet. The increasing source of use of imports suggests that, in fact, they are developing a more Western-style diet.
A couple of notes. In the article, you write that China's role in total world trade of animal protein has concurrently increased. Its role is now large enough for its import decisions to impact prices on many meat and dairy products. This pricing could dampen future growth in China's imports of these products. So demand internally stimulating, I think what you're telling me, production internally there. Is that correct?
That is correct. I would expect that China will, for most of the animal products, will continue to rely heavily on domestic sourcing. Of that production, they will want to grow their domestic sector in part to help their agriculture. And I think the question is that, you know, will they be able to grow fast enough? The evidence from the lab from this current decade or from the recent decade, depending on how you actually denote decades, has been that it's probably going to consistently grow, but not spectacularly grow, but they will become more of an importer. I think one of the more really interesting questions is going forward, particularly with respect to what I call bovine protein, which would be beef and dairy products. And given the characteristics of the Chinese production system and the fact that that bovine protein has not been historically a big part of the China diet, is will they become a major leader, both consumer and producer of alternative meats? And I'm thinking cellular-based meats here as well as plant protein beef meats. And I think that's going to be one of the really big questions, particularly if they really are developing a significant Western diet, which has a heavy emphasis upon animal proteins. Will they see it that they have to go to the alternative meats market in order to satisfy that? And I think that's a really big strategic question going forward.
And one of the key demand functions there could be that they have not had beef in their diets regularly. So the taste for beef rather than the alternatives might not have been developed already.
I think that's absolutely right. I think there's just, you know, the size of the China market, along with the historical characteristics of that market, suggest that it really could be a major player in the alternative meats markets, not only in China, but maybe around the world.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Todd, very much.
Carl Zuloff is with The Ohio State University. I spoke with him earlier in the month, along with Frayne Olson from NDSU, North Dakota State University, trying to get a better idea of what demand from China might look like going forward. You can learn more on our website at willag.org and, of course, on the Farm Doc Daily website at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. You're listening to Illinois Public Media.